Drums, please. Hi, it's me, Ashkenazi, your favourite North London Jewish queen. I am here to bring to you the secrets from the Pink Room.
Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room, Pink Room, Pink Room, not the Stink Room. Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room.
Hello, my bubblers, it's me, Ashkenazi, reminding you to douche regularly. Welcome to the Pink Room, the queerest backstage since the invention of the glory hole. Let's continue season two with some reconnecting. Back in August 2022, I was lucky enough to host a live podcast at Green Man Festival with the one and only Ezra Furman, punk provocateur, postmodern Jew, ex-touring buddy, and mother. Picture the scene. It's a rainy day in the Brecon Beacons. Last night's revelers emerged from tents pitched at awkward angles to each other, a new community forged against all rules of urban planning. A lone drag queen appears from the mist, carrying IKEA bags filled to the brim with drag ephemera, shoved in against all rules of effective packing. Sound checks rumble through the mountains, drowning out morning bird song against all rules of nature. I begin my 3-hour drag transformation with a Philips One blade, the drag queen weapon of choice for hair removal. I'm halfway through perfecting my Chad Kroger chin strap when the battery cuts dead. Luckily, I'm in the presence of my drag mum, Laura Barton. Not that she's a drag queen, but she is a mother. Have you got a spare electric shaver? Obviously not. But Laura tracks down a charger and I'm back on course. Drama 2. I forgot my knickers. Not to fear, the security have a spare pair of thermals which we cut into a thong. All potential flashing averted. Drama 3. I've forgotten a USB to record the podcast. No worries, Engineer Lux has one to hand. Drag do take a village. Ezra Furman pulls up in a golf buggy. It's been a whole pandemic worth of time since we've seen each other. And during that time, she has released an album, transitioned, and had a child. It's a huge amount to catch up on, but there's an immediate familiarity. The same wide-eyed fascination of the world around her. Arms folded, in pensive peculiarity. A side sweep of hair falling across her visage. Conversation is saved for the stage. We don't want the audience to miss out on this special moment.
Next up, we have someone who is one of my favourite people in all the world, an amazing drag performer. I like to call him my son or my daughter. Shall I call you my daughter when you're in that? Yeah, okay. My daughter, Ashkenazi, speaking to one of the Mountain Stage's absolute gems. It's Ashkenazi's Pink Room with Ezra Furman. Thank you.
Hi, it's me, Ashkenazi, your favourite North London Jewish queen. I am here to bring to you the secrets from the
Pink Room. Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room, Pink Room, Pink Room, Pink Room.
Hello, my bubblers. How are you all doing? I thought I'd give you a death drop, but it was a bit... wasn't very classy, was it? How's everyone's Green Man? Enjoying yourself? I am immensely too. My name is Ashkenazi, if you didn't know, and I'm here to remind you that trans rights are human rights. Thank you for that. And in the name of trans rights, I'd like to bring out a dear friend of mine, someone who I have looked up to for a very long time, someone who gives me reason to feel whole, someone who I would celebrate my Judaism with, which in the music industry is hard enough. I'd like to bring out onto stage the wonderful, the beautiful Ezra Furman.
Is a pile of shit. New life takes root in it.
It turns out that your mic technique is still as abysmal as it was in 2014.
I'm usually holding a guitar. That was a really nice intro.
Oh,
was,
thank
you're
you.
You're the sweetest.
It's all honesty. That's what we live for, right, these days?
Within reason.
Within, yeah. What couldn't you be honest about?
Oh, plenty of things. No, I've got no secrets. I guess I've stopped talking so much about myself lately. I stopped writing songs about myself. They started to not be about me anymore, which, I don't know. For me, that seems to be the way to do good. But I can try and talk a little about myself if you want me to.
Well, luckily today we're going to talk all about you. So
okay, all right. I'm going to be fine.
Or we can switch around at some point if you want to do that.
Okay, yeah, I mean...
When you get bored of yourself.
You're an interesting character too. You fascinate me.
So I think we need to start from the origin story. This is our genesis. So in 2014, I was told you can go on tour with a band if you provide them with a drum kit. And I was like, well, what a ridiculous idea. And I was like, this is great to go on tour, but I was like, the headliner provide the drum kit. So I was sitting in the van and I was all angry. I haven't told you this before. So I was all like, fuck this band. Like,
you brought your own.
Yeah.
And then you were like, wait, we didn't want you to use yours in the end.
Yeah.
We didn't want to do the changeover. Oh, I gotcha. That makes sense. Sorry.
We were all pissed off. And then when we met in that haunted church in Dundee.
Oh, yeah.
I've never met such a fabulous collection of, I want to say rambunctious.
Us?
Yeah.
Me? Us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there was...
They get wild. My band gets a little wild. Those were wild days, too.
They were wild days. I remember six to a Travelodge.
Yes, yeah, six people in one hotel room.
It was always...
Moronic.
It was, Ezra, can you try and get us to... Can you say on stage that we need to stay somewhere?
Yeah, yeah. That was still the days... Yes, I would ask from the stage, okay, this is not a joke. We need a place to stay tonight. We'll sleep on your couch. I've often slept on the floor or in a chair. We don't make noise. Please help us. We have no money. And that led to a lot of, it led to a few friendships, and it led to just a lot of uncomfortable, horrible nights of my life, you know?
Do you want to recount one of them?
Oh, God, I don't want to remember those. Like, you would end up sleeping on in like some punk house and you're like exhausted. It's like 1 a.m. You're like, okay, here's my jacket's a pillow and they gave me this thin blanket. And then it's like all their friends come over and they're like, yeah, we brought our friend. Like, let's hang out all night. And we're like, okay, we got to leave at 7, 8 a.m. And that'll be fine because you're hosting us. And we just treated ourselves like dirt. I didn't tell you this. I just found, like 5 days ago, I found this. I didn't even remember that I kept it. It was a meticulously detailed diary of that tour. Spring of 2014, when we met. And I was like keeping track of details. We were treating ourselves like dirt, like absolute dirt. And it was such a tender little time. And I'd like, dress feminine like sometimes on stage, like half the time, and I couldn't ask my friends for anything that I needed, you know, like, and then there'd be these entries where like I don't know why, but like it's like I'm just reading through like I slept 4 hours last night, slept on the floor last night, like drank a bunch of vodka last night, and then suddenly it's like I don't know why, but I want to die. How come I want to die all of a sudden? And it was like, I couldn't, somehow my diary writing self was not connecting. Like, oh, if you like drink heavily and don't sleep and there's intense pressure on you every night and you never, tell your friends that you're trans, that makes you want to die.
it brings a new, because I was thinking about that tour and I was thinking about the songs you play, and it does bring a new understanding of some of those songs. So like I Want to Destroy Myself was a really great song I used to play. And that takes on a whole new meaning. And Sunglasses as well, which was, and
yeah,
it, I have happy memories of Sunglasses.
Yeah.
How is that, does that song sit well in your memory, or do you struggle to listen to it, or even, well, I know you don't play it anymore, but how do you feel about those songs now, having come out as trans?
Oh, yeah. They feel young and repressed to me, like not actualized. I could see how people thought they were charming. And they're good. I think they're good. I just think I've done a lot better. I would still play them. Some of the, like those two, those hold up. Like we have other older songs that are just not good. I feel a little embarrassed about, but like, yeah, but it would feel different to play I Want to Destroy Myself now, because I successfully got what I wanted.
So
it was dark, and it seemed like this Iggy Pop like self-destruction thing, and it kind of was, but it was really like what I want. What if it was like, what if you want to, what if you're doing self-destruction so that you can make a new self, because you need to, you know, and in that way. So later on when we were still playing it, I would always be like, this is a positive song. And I don't know if that, if it ever came off that way. It was written on like the one of those worst nights of my life kind of nights. But
it's interesting, the idea of destruction and queerness. I think there's an element from my coming out process, there was a huge element of destruction in order to get to a place where I felt myself. Yeah. How did your version of destruction represent itself? Was that something that you identify with?
Yeah, I just accrued a bunch of crap that was not good for me. And like, you gotta understand, people are surprised to find that I am shy off stage, and that especially back in the day, I was like wildly repressed. I was like extra special, can't talk to almost anyone kind of repressed, like at all. And it used to surprise people because I'd go on stage and like be a little wild and screamy and stuff. But it's just because like I would just get steamrolled in every social situation my whole life and never be able to even put together what I had to say to somebody. And then there's this place where you get to, no one else can talk while you're talking, and you get to write it in advance, and everyone has to listen to you. And the whole time you're doing it, you're at a party, but you don't have to talk to anyone at the party. It's like, it was like medicine for me, like the perfect place to like finally like, okay, this is a place to figure out what I feel. It was that same dynamic that meant that like the first time I like looked feminine and wore a dress in front of anyone like, other than like some friend whose dress I borrowed and swore to secrecy, like that happened on stage. But yeah, it like, but the stage really was like a rehearsal for my life.
That's something that resonates with me. I was very repressed in my sexuality and, you know, would claim my straightness at all times.
In 2014,
And in 20...
Thought I just missed it. I thought I was like, how did I fucking miss? And, sorry, am I not supposed to swear?
You can swear. We can swear. Last year, my balls popped out at this point, so we're doing much better already.
I just didn't know if that was... a moment that was audible on the podcast, you know?
It's all right.
Which editing, I could imagine it being.
The editing suite is very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2014, how were you identifying? Because I was identifying as straight and, you know, like in an indie band, drummer. Da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, yeah. I guess I was... I don't know. I told some people that I was like bisexual, and sometimes I wore a dress, but like I didn't have any words for any of it. And I was sort of like aggressively like, don't ask me about, like, no, I'm not gonna choose one of these categories. I think because I was just like kind of avoidant, but I think some people, I think I was one of these people who needed some space, some time to just try stuff. And I didn't want a label. And I was trying to, I kind of framed it as like a rebellious thing. Like, I don't owe anybody an explanation. I hardly ever like came out to anyone. I never liked the idea of coming out because it always just felt like a, it just felt like a ritual for straight people to like forgive you and to be like, you're such a freak and it's okay. And like, I'd just be like, I don't want to do that with you. Okay. I don't want to make you, I don't know. But, I think also I leaned a little too hard in that direction. I should have come out a little more often or like tried on some labels or something. I was mostly just like, don't talk to me about this.
So the multi-million dollar question that I have played with, and I wonder if you've played with it too in your head, was being in a band restrictive to being your true self, or did it encourage you to be your true self? Because I'm in two minds about this. The stage was my respite. The stage was where I didn't have to think, oh, I've got to hide my queerness whatsoever. So it was a point of hyper focus where nothing mattered. And so the stage was my home space. The stage was where I felt beautiful. And it took a long time for me to bring that into my reality. But I always do think the nature of bands when we were in 2014, was it almost, I felt sometimes it was, you know, well, I'm in a band. I, you know, every other band I see has to be straight. Kind of representation, which is slowly degrading over time. But I wonder for you whether, do you think the band was something that might have restricted you from, you know, if you'd had more space and not been on tour, would you have found yourself earlier?
I don't know. I mean, I think about, like, we were both in bands with straight dudes, you know, like, just in this, and that wasn't great for me. I mean, part of why I was so repressed is that, like, I spent my whole youth just always with the bros, being like, I can do this too. And, it was corrosive. It was corrosive, man. And I should have joined up with more gays more often, you know, more queer people. But yeah, and then the just like whole rock band world is just like, it's so masculine, and I don't know. I think I could tell, like, the stage was a portal to freedom, but like, it wasn't enough to get me all the way there. And that whole thing of like never being home and always on tour and treating myself poorly. I feel like I don't want to denigrate my younger self. I don't want to blame. I'm always just like lamenting. Like, I feel like every trans person does this. Like, I should have come out sooner. How did I not see it? And it's like, you just take whatever time it takes. It might be decades. You shouldn't blame yourself for it, you know? It's like, blame the world. Blame the world. Blame others for transphobia.
I wholeheartedly agree. I'm at a point now where actually I recognize when I first came out as gay, I really hated that it had taken so long. But the skills I gained by being in the closet, like if I went into an acting agency, which is something I'd never do, I would turn to the agent and I would say, book me. I'm the best actor of our generation because I acted straight for 24 years.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And maybe I've just never capitalized on those skills. To me, it feels like a huge waste of time. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I feel like I'm more learned how to just, like, lie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the lying. That's the killer.
I'm pretty good at, like, avoiding situations. And that doesn't seem like a very good skill to have. But sometimes, there are some situations that should be avoided.
Absolutely.
Don't sell myself short.
I wanted to give a more positive story from our time in 2014. One of my favorite moments was we got to stay at Benji's house in Oxford.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
respite. That was such a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
We were like, this is not six people in a hotel room giving us tea.
And we had your manager on the sofa bed. But
oh, God.
I remember handing you Ribena. You were like, oh, I need a soft drink. So I handed you Ribena.
He can't.
Okay. And you poured the whole bottle into a pint glass.
Oh, yeah, I never heard of it before. Yeah. I was like, thanks. And I, like, drank the whole... I feel like you guys just watched me do it without telling me.
Oh, yeah. And the sugar high afterwards was immense.
That was...
I also wanted to... One other thing was... I don't know whether you had felt this at the time, but... Other members of the band, when we first met them, so Sam in particular, your drummer.
Yes, my beloved.
The beloved Sam Durkees.
He's a genius.
I turned to him in Dundee at the first ever gig. We'd already made close friends. It was, you know, drummers alike. And he was telling me that, you know, this is my last ditch attempt at a tour and an album. This, like, if this doesn't work, I'm out. Like, yeah. I've got my name on the day... Is it Day of the Dog?
Day of the Dog was out, yes.
I've got my name on the Day of the Dog record. I'm happy with that. Do this last tour. If it doesn't lead to anything, fine. I'm happy. I've done what I've done. To put a positive spin on it, mm-hmm. You're doing amazingly now. You're two records further than Day of the Dog.
Oh, more than that. That's, I...
Perpetual Motion and now...
No, there's been more than that. I can't remember.
And I'm just so amazed that you managed to make it work.
We were at the end of our rope. We were. That was after I had already decided to quit. It was too brutal. And then I quit at the end of 2013. While on tour in the U.S., like, you know, going, just dragging ourselves through the mud. And I was like, this is not the best I can do with my 20s. Come on, it's horrible. And then I got home and I was like, that was the last tour ever, I think. And then it was like, you just got 5 stars in The Guardian. They're playing a song on the radio in England all the time. And it was all here. And then it was like, you got to go to the U.K. And I was like... Fine, I'll do one more tour. And then, like, every show was sold out. And it was like, we were just sitting in the cafe and heard our song on the radio, you know, by chance. And we were like, something's, I guess we shouldn't quit right now. And then the next one, we were like, let's go back again. We were like, I guess maybe this could work out, but it probably still won't. And it's so painful. But it was like, Let's just see. There's something happening, maybe. And, yeah, it took a while. It was, like, 3 years of just being like, no, but the next tour, that's the one we're going to like make money and we can stay in multiple hotel rooms. The next one, this one's bad. Yes. And the last three were bad. And but the next one, you know, somehow I lied to myself for long enough that now I get to talk to glamorous people like you. Oh, wait, no, we were hanging out then, I remember. We were just less glamorous.
Yeah, yeah. The glamour is real now. You know, we're in our bougie period, Ezra. Like, we've
Are
got...
We?
Yeah, we've got yurts.
I have a yurt.
Oh, you've got hotels.
Oh, yeah.
Cottages.
Yeah, we don't sleep on people's floors anymore. Stop doing that. That's pretty bougie. You're
that
right.
is bougie.
We get multiple rooms at the Travelodge now.
And
living like a queen.
Yeah, the queen that you are.
you're too kind.
Hey, everybody, I'm Dave Holmes.
And I'm Matt McConkie.
And we are the hosts of Homophilia, the podcast where we talk to awesome LGBTQ+ people about the pop culture that they are consuming and loving and the love lives that they are leading. The conversations that we wish we had had access to when we were growing up, the conversations that we would like to eavesdrop on now, but we have them with the coolest people in the world. Like who, Matt?
Sir Andy Cohen himself.
What?
Michael Patrick King, Tig Notaro, Alan Cumming, Jinx Monsoon, and Vendela Creme. Countless queens from the Drag Race universe. We're asking all of them about the pop culture milestones that shaped them as queer people, and more importantly, who they're having sex with.
There you go. It's the queer conversation they don't want you to have. We're having it on Homophilia every week on the World of Wonder Network. Tune in.
Listen to Homophilia on the WOW Podcast Network or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
One of the things that you started talking about when we were on tour in 2014, and now that you have realized yourself, you have stuck to, you started talking about not doing shows on a Friday night. Specifically,
yeah.
I remember you started telling me that you weren't going to do shows on a Friday night at a church, at which we were told we weren't allowed to swear, and you went straight up on stage and went, shit.
Because, okay, yeah, I didn't... I remember that church, and they were like, by the way, you can't swear on stage. And I was like, oh, is that like the law? And she was like, it's God's law. And I was like, excuse me? And I didn't mean to swear on, I wanted to respect the religion that has murdered my people for generations. But
it wasn't our God.
Well, I had a rough night that night. I like didn't eat anything all day, and I drank some giant like frozen drink from Starbucks right before the show. Like, I don't know what I was thinking, but I like had a bit of a, I feel like I had a near psychotic episode in that show. And I was imagining the church was like haunted with all the prayers of people who had prayed there. And they were all kind of coursing through me, and I'm like, maybe I'm gonna become a cult leader or something. And yeah, after that show I couldn't stop laughing. I can't remember if we were hanging out. I couldn't stop laughing. It was dicey. Those were dicey mental health days. But yeah, that was the, I think that tour was the, I wasn't keeping Shabbat, the day of rest, yet really, like I wanted to, but we weren't playing on Friday nights. So just to explain, like, I keep Shabbat in the seventh day, the day of rest, from Friday night at sundown to when the stars come out Saturday. I do not work. I do not spend money. I do not write. There's all this stuff. I don't use electronics at all. And I make it the sacred day. I don't use a phone. And it's a deeper practice than I think it even sounds like it is, but it's kind of an anchor of my whole inner life. And yeah, that was when I was just starting it. It was such a tender time that we met. I was just like, maybe I like look like feminine sometimes, and maybe I'm really into Judaism in a traditional way sometimes, but I wasn't like asking to be respected in these things yet. I was just like, maybe this, is everyone okay? I'll just stop. If anyone doesn't like this, I'll stop. You know, like I was so timid about it. And I'm so glad I'm less timid.
I think it's very bold of you to stick by your boundaries and push through what you consider yourself to be. So for me, when you were talking to me, I remember in 2014, you said to me, you know, Ash, I'm thinking of, you know, I'm not going to do shows on Fridays. And I remember thinking, well, that's absolutely nuts, because capitalism says you got to do shows on the Friday, like Friday night's the big one, right?
I know.
Now,
but yeah.
When I sat down to think about what we were going to talk about, I realized that is the most punk statement you can make. Sitting down and saying, I'm not going to do Fridays. I'm not going to live by the capitalist rules. I'm not going to live by the machine. I'm going to take my day of rest and you're going to abide by it. To me, that's punk.
Yeah, well, I always felt like I had a lot of practice from being into punk culture for that. I mean, they were like, I know they're culturally like so incongruous, like traditional Judaism and like punk rock type shit. And they always thematically, like they always reinforced each other. For me, it's like, I'm gonna not be into the stuff that I'm sort of supposed to be into. I'm gonna go this other way and be fiercely loyal to this way that like, no one's asking me to follow, and is a bit of a... I always read Judaism to have a strong streak of fuck you in it. It's like, it's a counterculture. It is a counterculture. I think at its best, it's anti-authoritarian. I mean, like, I'm not like, yeah, I'm just like not intimidated by anybody. I was just thinking about this because I met this very famous rock and roll person recently, and I was like, I guess I'm supposed to be like, I would have been nervous about this in the past, but like, I don't know. I like talk to God every day. I face God. I'm not really worried about human authorities, because they're just, I'm just like, we're all gonna die, buddy. We're all gonna die.
That reminds me of one of your very earliest songs, God is a Woman.
God is a middle-aged woman.
That's what it's called.
That's right. Were we playing that back then? Maybe we were. Yeah, I guess probably.
So your reality was deep in your songs from the beginning. It just couldn't be expressed outwardly.
Oh, yeah. All the signs are there that I was like a Jewish queer. Yeah. So those were all, they were already, it's not like I wasn't, I've been obsessed with God my whole life, basically, in different ways.
So on April the 4th, 1993, God came down and talked to you.
Yes. You're referencing a lyric from a song of mine.
I know, from the new album. Could you...
Which comes out on Friday, everybody.
How exciting.
What's your question about April 4th, 1993?
I want to know what happened on April 4th, 1993.
Oh, I believe I was clear on the song. God came down to talk to me through a stone at my window to get my attention, motioned to me to climb down the wall.
But you didn't.
I was afraid to fall. I was young, and I didn't want to bother my mother.
No Jewish child wants to bother their mother.
But, you know, I guess, like, I was just best buds with God when I was a little kid, you know, because I went to a Jewish school and they made us pray every day. And I don't know, I guess like when I was a kid, it just seemed, it didn't seem like a difficult relationship. It didn't seem like a difficult thing to believe or what. I didn't have, just like, it made intuitive sense to a young child. And some kids, I think, like have this, it's like very vivid, you know, like William Blake had a childhood vision when he was like 7 years old, and he says God put his head to the window, and that's how he describes this vision he had when he was a child, that like he remembered his whole life, and like I saw God when I was a kid. And I think this is, I have this strong sense that that kind of thing is not to be dismissed as childhood fantasy. Like, I don't know, kids are in touch with something mysterious that, like, I think it's a muscle we can, it's sort of a skill we can turn off or build.
There's something you discuss in your podcast called...
Oh, my podcast.
Yeah, tell us about your
podcast. It's called Two Queers, Four Questions. I never promote it. I like hardly ever talk about it.
Here's your chance.
Okay. You should all listen to it. It's very good. It's me and this amazing trans woman named Agnes Berinsky, who writes plays and makes theater. And we're going through all the Jewish holidays and asking four questions from a like queer countercultural perspective on these Jewish holidays. And like, she's brilliant. I'm brilliant. It's quite good, but it's very niche, you know, it's very, it's this built-in thing when you're like religious in this, in a secular world, in a secular context, you're just like, the timidness, those timid instincts from years of closetedness. I'm just like, I know nobody wants to talk about this, and I'm just like literally thinking about it all the time. And I don't like when someone just like, someone brings up like Jesus or something, I just am like, gonna maybe leave the room, just let's see what you say next, you know? And so I understand the, we've got religion baggage. I've got religion baggage. It's not like an uncomplicated love of this tradition that reads a book that legislates the death penalty for my sexuality, you know? It's complicated. But anyway, like, I just feel like we queers still fall in love with God and fall in love with old, there's just all this ancestral wisdom. I don't want to kick it to the curb. So me and Agnes talk about it. And what did you ask?
There's one episode that I remembered just now, because I think it rings true to what you're talking about. This idea in Judaism of returning.
Oh, yeah.
And that you spoke to God on April the 4th, 1993.
Yeah.
And then you went through a period of not talking to God, but somehow you're returning to your childhood state. And for me, you know, as a child, one of, you know, my most memorable moments was getting up in drag at the age of 11 and singing Blow Gabriel Blow from Anything Goes at the school disco.
Oh, cool.
It goes a bit like this. Blow Gabriel Blow. Anyway.
More.
A mighty low Gabriel blow. I've been a sinner, I've been a scamp, but now I'm willing to trim my lamp. So yeah. Blow Gabriel blow.
Yeah. You can do the whole thing. Oh, you should sing the rest of the time.
I mean,
I like it.
Last year I did some opera. Should we do some opera again?
Some what?
Opera.
Opera?
Opera.
Do I? You can.
I do opera.
Okay, I don't. I do the occasional rock opera.
Oh, yeah. American Idiot?
No, just my own transangelic exodus. Sort of a bit of that, but no, I...
We'll end on some opera. Just you. Now you have to stay. Now you can't leave. How many Jews have we got in the room, by the way? 1, 2, 3, 3, 4, 5.
All right. Not a...
That's pretty representative, no?
Yeah. Not enough to say Kaddish, but... If we can...
You have to explain that now to the Gentiles.
Oh. You're supposed to have 10 people together to say certain prayers, including the prayer for the dead, which is called Kaddish, the mourner's Kaddish. Jokes are always best when you explain them. I'm told.
Which part of the Jewish kind of rhetoric would you point to as trans? What do you relate to? Are there any particular passages
or
holidays that you feel, you know, at the time when this actually happened, you know, people weren't stuck in their gender specific roles? One that comes to mind is Purim, but maybe that's a little...
Purim's a complicated one. Yeah. I mean, first thing I think of when you say, like, where is Judaism trans is, like, maybe this is way too broad, but, like, I feel like there's a fundamental thing that Judaism was a... It was a reaction to the ancient world where, like, the king is the king because he's a god. The poor people are poor because they don't matter. And that's the way it is. The powerful win, the weak lose. Nothing can ever change. And it has, like, it's the founding conceptual idea of Judaism is that the slaves go out of Egypt and they become not slaves. They like a person in a category socially can turn into a person of a different category. And, like, it's this great, it is like a foundational conceptual rebellion that, like, something could change, that the world how it is and society how it is isn't, like, permanent. It isn't how it's supposed to be, which is, like, a lot of religions are more about, like, yes, the world, like, it sort of ensconces the world, like, the world is, let's just accept it. And there's this, like, non-acceptance that is, like, the core thing of Judaism. And I don't know, me being able to be trans is, like, some kind of outgrowth of that learned concept, of that, like, foundational thing of, like, let's perfect the world, let's perfect ourselves. But it's just, like, not accept things how they are. Now, that doesn't, I mean, like, it doesn't mean the Bible's not, like, transphobic and queerphobic. It is. It super is. But there's this, the thing is, you can't just read the Bible. That's, like, 1% of the story with Judaism. There's all this, you gotta, they just read it for centuries, and they talk about it, and they change it, and they're, like, it's the opposite of fundamentalism. I mean, a lot of Jewish practices and rules are directly the opposite of what is legislated in the text of the Bible. And it's like a bold tradition in that way. It's like, let's meet this book. Let's ask God to come to us a little bit as we come toward her, you know?
So that brings me nicely on to motherhood.
Oh, motherhood.
You have a child.
I have a child.
A child was born.
A toddler. A 3-ish year old.
And how does that fit in with your current schedule and life?
It's fraught. Ash, what do you... It's right now... No, it's a strange situation. we had all that time off. I mean, I didn't play a show for over 2 years, and I was excited to get back to it. And now the excitement is, I mean, I was already keeping the tour short. I feel like I got to keep them super extra short. I'm going home on Thursday. I just got here on Friday. But are you asking me about logistics?
I'm not asking you about logistics. I think I'm asking you more about the cohabiting between motherhood and, you know, being a punk rocker and your Judaism. How does that live out day to day? I believe that those things can all cohabit.
Yeah. Well, I don't... I just know that I love parenting. I love being a mom. It seems like much... It seems like work that I'm much more suited to than really anything else I've done.
That's beautiful.
It's also... There's a lot of... It's like, it's just been really... spiritually good for me. I have this job where I self-promote and I put my name on big signs and on the fronts of records. It's all about me. I'm the lone genius who, like, is the center of attention, and my band's name is my name. And that's kind of, it's just like the, I'm leaning a lot more toward things that are, I'm getting a lot more focused on community and collaboration. It's always been collaborative, of course, but like something I think kind of pushed me in the culture of the rugged individualist. And I think that is a bad, model. There is no lone genius in the world. There's no lone wolves. We all depend on each other. And it's kind of like rot starts to set in. If that's how it feels to me. Like, you, like, if you really think like you're a self-made person, first of all, you're wrong. And second of all, like, it's bad for you. It's like I could feel it being kind of bad for me. And then being a parent, it makes you organize your life around love and care. And seeing that, I don't know, and interdependence. Anyway, that's like the main thing I've also been writing about. And this ironic thing happened where I wrote this whole record about that, and then it's like, oh, now I have to go out on my own and play the lone wolf and be away from my family and my community. And I don't know. It's an unresolved sort of tension. I think it's okay. I think, like, I can do both jobs. But it takes a lot of help, and I refuse to be, like, a continually absent parent for long stretches of time. I just can't do it. So listen, I've been saying it since 2014. This might be the end of the line for the touring musician
Could I,
job.
Tell you that one of the things that brought me closer to my parents was going to boarding school. And I don't, you know, I don't tend to tell anyone how to parent, but I think there is beauty in separation, and then the coming back together is so much stronger. It's so much more fulfilling. You know you want to be there. And so when those moments come together, like this coming together for me has been inspiring, because really, we haven't seen each other since 2014.
Kind of, yeah.
And
barely at all.
I think both of us are the same, but different.
But like, wouldn't we be better friends if we'd been hanging out?
I don't think so.
Yeah, maybe we'd hate each other.
Maybe.
Listen, I hear what you're saying. I just really miss my little baby. And I'm co-parenting with someone who also works. And I can't really allow the like imbalance of like who knows what's going on, who's doing all that work that it takes like to get out of whack, you know. We're just like so fiercely like egalitarian about who's doing the work of parenting, and I've seen so many, I don't know, it's such a dynamic that like one person becomes like the main parent and the other person like sort of like they can also sometimes help, and it's just like so gross to me. Maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe that's just like baggage, but like I'm just like I gotta get home. I can't get out of touch with the routine of being home. It's like my favorite, it's the job I was born to do, I'm telling you. And also, I was home doing it for this whole pandemic. Was I able to make art and write songs? Yes, I was. I wrote the best songs of my life. And you can still, I find it a lot easier to balance writing songs with being a parent than balancing writing songs with being on tour all the time. Like, a lot easier. But I do love the stage. I don't want to denigrate the stage, and I don't want to leave it for good, okay? Don't worry. I will come to your drag brunch.
You really don't want to come to the brunch. You haven't seen the Huns do Prosecco. Like, I have one last question.
Okay.
And this is for everyone here who might be going through some sort of transition or looking into their queerness. What would you say to those people right now who are here who might be having questions about gender or sexuality? And what is your kind of positive way of thinking about it? Because I know that when I thought about being gay when I was in the closet, that was a really negative feeling, really brought me down. So how can you switch the thought process to make it positive?
Yeah, I'm always wary of like papering over what sucks about being queer in a queerphobic world. So let's leave all that sucks about it to the side, and also just mention that, like, as I said, like, it's not something wrong with us, it's something wrong with society that it is like afraid of us. But other than that, like, I think it's something that I had to learn. I hope I say this right. That you, no matter who you are, not just queer people, all people have to make a self or somehow find a way to be. Everybody's doing it. Like, that is how you be a person. You make a person and then be that person. And like, queer people just have to do it. Like, I think trans people, it's just more obvious that we have to make ourselves. I was not fed anything about the way I am, you know? I had to find it, make it, declare it. And there's just more resistance because of the aforementioned queerphobic world. But like, Everybody has to do that. It's a legitimate thing to do. Someone cannot tell you, like, but you used to be like this. How can you be like this now? Everybody used to be a different way. We used to be eggs and sperm. And like, so like change and transformation, this is what you're supposed to do in a human life. And don't let them try to stop you. Because if you know, you know.
I'm inspired. Again.
Hey. Podcast
I was
us.
Inspired in 2014 and I'm inspired in 2022. Thank you so much for being here, for being yourself, for teaching us new ways of living. I do think it's everyone should listen to the podcast, whether you're interested in Judaism or not.
My podcast.
Sorry.
You mean my podcast?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good.
It's a different way of living. It's a way of thinking about the world, not in its machine capitalist form. And I think what better way to spend a Sunday afternoon at Green Man than with Ezra Furman.
Thanks for having me.
So thank you so much. Thank you all for staying. You can stand up.
I stand.
Yeah, stand. I'd also like to thank my mother, Laura. These are two of my favorite people in the world. So.
And also, can you all thank yourselves, because you've been such a beautiful Talking Shop audience this year. You've been amazing and so loving to all of our performers. So round of applause for all of you, please. Most of all, for Miss Ashkenazi, Miss Ezra Furman, two of the most beautiful, brilliant women in music. Thank you so much.
Are we doing opera?
You're now going to do some opera. You can sing us off.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, this is going to take a bit of technical jiggery, but let me... how long is this microphone? Ooh, okay. I feel like opera is a good way. Hello, sound engineer. Let me just go to vamp. Mother, vamp.
Vamp.
Hang on.
Welcome to Green Man Festival. It was founded in 1773.
20 years ago, actually. 20 years this year. This is the 20th year.
Yeah. cool. I think I had that right. 20 years ago, a group of chemically greenish-tinged men convened this festival for the sole purpose of drag queens singing opera. And their dream has never been fulfilled until this moment.
No other festival has a drag queen singing opera apart from Green Man. I've enjoyed this so much. Thank you for staying. DJ, start the track.
Excuse me. Should I leave? Do I go?
No. You stay. Okay. You're part of the performance.
Okay. Stand, sit.
You stay.
Mother, you come too. I'm Carmen, if you didn't gather. 8:15
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
8:15 on the main stage.
Also,
don't miss
it. Ezra's books are for sale next door.
Oh yeah, books for sale. 33 1/3
Yeah, I wrote a book about Lou Reed's Transformer. That album.
All about the track. The mushrooms really didn't help with my breathing technique. Oh,
Yes.
Thanks for listening to that special edition of the Pink Room live at Green Man Festival. A huge thanks, of course, goes to Ezra for her honesty and time, to the Talking Shop team of Laura Barton, Ed Fest and Sandra Barnes, who made it all happen, and to Lux O'Neill and the SFL team on engineering duties. The Pink Room is a World of Wonder production, produced by Michael Pressman and Charlie Kearns, and edited by Jesse Caron. I'm Ashkenazi. If you enjoyed The Pink Room, please subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends. And remember, Queens, what happens on tour definitely gets shared in The Pink Room. Ta-ra for now!
Si tu veux